You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
It's January 5th, 1941. The skies are gray and filled with water, ready at any minute to pour down to the earth below. Amy Johnson, whom many people refer to as the British Amelia Earhart, is soaring through the air, her eyes fixed on the horizon, her heart beating with excitement and trepidation. Little does she know that she's about to live the final moments of her life. Up to this point, the flight has been largely uneventful. But as Johnson approaches the Thames estuary, she begins to encounter poor weather conditions. This is, as they say, where the story ends and theory begins. It's believed by many that Amy becomes disoriented in the bad weather and as a result flies off course. At the time, Johnson's radio also begins to malfunction, making it difficult for her to receive any assistance from air traffic control. Or maybe she didn't have a radio at all. The winds are turbulent. The air is thick with mist and fog. Amy's plane, an Airspeed Oxford, is a speck in the vast expanse of the sky, its wings flapping frantically against the raging elements. She'd taken off from an airfield in England, bound for Scotland, a journey she'd undertaken many times before. But this time, there's something different in the air, something ominous, something foreboding. Amy had always been a fearless aviator, a trailblazer, who had broken barriers and shattered stereotypes. She'd become a national hero, a symbol of courage and determination. But now, as she flies over the cold and unforgiving waters of the North Sea, she's facing her greatest challenge yet. The plane's engine sputters and coughs, a harbinger of the tragedy that's about to unfold. Amy tries desperately to regain control, to steer the plane back on course. But it appears it's too little, too late. As Johnson continues flying, her plane's fuel supply begins to run desperately low. And now, she has to make a call. No one really knows for sure what happens next. The official story will tell you that having seemingly run out of fuel, Johnson makes an emergency jump from her aircraft and lands in the violent icy current. But maybe a bit of luck. As she goes down, a convoy of ships notices her parachute in the distance, and a nearby vessel, the HMS Hazelmere, races to the downed Johnson. Despite the crew's best efforts to reach her, their ropes are just out of reach, and the violent crashing of waves isn't helping the situation. When she goes down, Amy's wearing a heavy flying suit, and she struggles to stay afloat in the freezing water. Despite losing their own captain in their attempts, Amy's lost to sea and presumed dead. Her body is never recovered. Johnson's watertight flying bag, along with her logbook and checkbook, later wash up and were recovered near the shores of the wreck site. The news of Amy's disappearance sends shockwaves across the world, a testament to the impact she'd made on the aviation industry. In a last letter to her friend Carolyn Hazlett on New Year's Day 1941, Johnson wrote, quote, "I hope the gods will watch over you this year, and I wish you the best of luck, the only useful thing not yet taxed," end quote. The exact cause of the accident that led to Johnson's death is still unclear, but if you're looking for an official story, that's it. But in recent years, another explanation has been offered, and it's one that calls to a more tragic ending for one of aviation's biggest icons. A woman's name you've likely never heard of, until now. Welcome back to Vanished. This is Amy Johnson. Welcome back to Vanished and the continuation of Season 3. Tonight, we return to the skies and we return to aviation, finally. I am Chris Williamson and you are Jennifer Taylor. How are you doing tonight?
And how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to get back to aviation. If you've been waiting for us to get back to aviation, if you're an old school Vanished aficionado, then tonight is for you. It's your night. We've been talking about this one for a while now. An aviator not named Amelia Earhart. Can you imagine that?
Wait, those exist?
They're out there. There's more than a few. What are your thoughts as we step back into the world of aviation and into the life of a woman that many people have never heard her name before?
I have to admit, I also hadn't heard of her before until you brought me the case. From what little I know about her, I hope to learn more about her throughout this episode, but what little I do know about her, she seems like kind of a badass. And so I'm really excited to talk about her.
She was quite impressive. All right. Well, without further ado, let's just get right into it. And I'll give you a brief rundown of who we're talking about tonight and why we feel she's so important. Amy Johnson is born on July 1st of 1903. She's born in Hull, England to John William Johnson and Amy Hodge. And she's the oldest of four children. Her father, John, was a pretty wealthy fish merchant. So her family lived in a pretty large house in an upscale and a fashionable part of Hull, not unlike Earhart living in Atchison in an upscale house with her grandparents at the time. What's interesting to me is that from the gate, as a child, she's fascinated by the stories of pilots and their planes as she reads them, you know, in various magazines and books and things of that nature. On the academic side, she attends the Boulevard Municipal Secondary School in Kingston. She's a good student, and she shows a particular talent for both math and science, which is interesting. After completing schooling, she enrolls at the University of Sheffield, where she studies economics. After she nabs a bachelor's from the University of Sheffield, she goes on to work as a secretary for a London law firm from 1925 to 1929. She joins the London Aeroplane Club at de Havilland Aerodrome, referred to as Stag Lane. I know that's a tongue twister a little bit, British sayings. One of her first flight instructors was a gentleman by the name of Captain Valentine Henry Baker, who was a World War I fighter pilot, and he'd later go on to co-found the Martin Baker Aircraft Company, which is a very interesting little side note there. Amy trains in a de Havilland DH-60, a Circus II Moth, and on June 9th of 1929, after 15 hours and 45 minutes, she completes her first solo flight. After her solo flight, she really becomes an accomplished pilot, and she earns her pilot's license. It only takes her 6 months. You know, she's a risk taker, as you mentioned. She's a badass. She's a fly-by-the-seat-of-her-pants kind of girl, and it doesn't really take long for that skill, her determination, really, and the fierceness in her to be noticed by the aviation world, and she's offered a job as a pilot by a company very familiar to her at this point, de Havilland, which, in case you're wondering, is still around today, interestingly enough. Amy's first major achievement arrives in May of 1930, when she becomes the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia. She completes the 11,000-mile journey in just 19 days, again, flying a de Havilland Gypsy Moth that she nicknamed Jason.
We're leaving out a part of the name of this plane. Gaw.
I did leave that out. That is a great name.
Also, she had a sister named Irene, which I find interesting. One of life's little synchronicities.
It is very interesting. So the flight she makes from England to Australia, this is her version, I think, of the 1928 transatlantic friendship flight that Amelia completes, and it's also in 1928. This is really what earns Amy like a widespread acclaim, you know, makes her a household name. After she completes the flight, she's actually, it's funny, she's awarded 10 grand as a completion reward by the Daily Mail, which is kind of interesting.
Dude.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money now.
That's a lot of money now, but then in 1928, $10,000.
It's already like a rich person's hobby to fly planes. So that's crazy.
It's about 180 grand now if she were to complete the flight now.
Good for her.
You know, yeah, almost shy of 200,000. That's not bad comparatively. So she gets that 10 grand and she's actually issued license number one by the Australian Air Ministry. And this is really cool. This is one of my favorite parts of the story. She's bestowed the honor of being, quote, commander of the most excellent order of the British Empire by King George V, which is a great, great name.
That is a great name. They're all about the ceremony over across the pond.
They really, really are. And it's so good, I want to read you the official proclamation because I think it's pretty great. Quote, "The king has been graciously pleased on the occasion of His Majesty's birthday to give orders for the following promotions in and appointments to the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. To be commanders of the civil division of the said Most Excellent Order, Miss Amy Johnson, in recognition for her outstanding flight to Australia." So that's the official proclamation, which I thought was pretty cool. After the 28 flight and all of the accolades as a result of it, Amy's all in to push the boundaries of what she can do in the sky. So she sets several records for speed and distance, including a record for the fastest flight from London to Cape Town, which she achieves in 1932. She also becomes the first woman to fly solo from England to Japan, completing that 9,000-mile journey in just 12 days. You know, it's interesting. We talk about her being really the British Amelia Earhart. It's interesting to note that she's doing the same things that Earhart is doing almost at the very same time, just in another part of the world. It's pretty interesting. It's almost like dueling careers to a degree. In 1932, Amy marries Jim Mollison, who's another celebrated aviator, and they marry in a very high-profile ceremony. They've got some money. It's at a church in the Church of St. Bartholomew the Great in London.
Did he really propose to her, like, the same day he met her? Is that true?
Like, within 8 hours, I think. Yeah, something like that. Very quickly. It was definitely a 90-day fiancé kind of thing.
So I have absolutely no room to criticize this move. Mm-mm. Like, none at all.
It's a bold move.
However, that is very fast.
It's very fast.
It is very fast.
When you know, you know. Or maybe not. Hold that thought.
They did get divorced.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah,
sorry to spoil.
I mean, in retrospect, perhaps this was red flag number
right.
one.
Right. I mean, after their wedding, they continue to pursue flying together. Just 6 years later, their marriage becomes strained by Jim's infidelity and they divorce in 1938. Interestingly enough, though, talking about synchronicities, while they were married, they were briefly known as the Sweetheart Flyers. They were known as this because they attempted a flight from Wales to New York and they fell just short, crashing in some kind of a drainage ditch or something just outside of Connecticut. Ironically enough, though, as a result of the crash, and maybe despite it, the United States rolls out the red carpet for both of them, and it's here that she meets FDR and Amelia Earhart for the first time. And her and Amelia remain close confidants until the day Earhart disappears, actually.
Very cool connection. I have to say, as somebody that has attempted to kayak with my soulmate, I don't think flying together was the best thing for their marriage.
Probably not. They were probably both very competitive flyers, too. And she was, as you say, a badass. And I agree with you 100%. Mm-hmm. So I don't think she probably took much from him.
She's wealthy in her own right. Is she wealthier than he is?
No, I don't think so. I think he's probably got a little bit more money. But she's nothing to sneeze at, really. I mean, she's got some money. She's got some notoriety. She's becoming really well known.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering if maybe that contributed to it because it's 1930s. Women aren't supposed to have their own property and money and things like that. Like, you know, we are property at that time.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, maybe not legally, but she's kind of making a name for herself. So I can see that being a strain on a normal marriage.
She could have been making enough of a name for herself to where, you know, that challenged her husband's masculinity. Maybe, who knows? Not really sure. It's at this point that World War II breaks out, and in 1939, Amy volunteers herself for service in the ATA, which is the Air Transport Auxiliary. They were a civilian organization that really just transported aircraft from factories to military bases, so on and so forth. They moved aircraft and moved things. And this is an experience that gives her the chance to pilot sort of a wide variety of aircraft. Spitfires, Hurricanes, Lancaster bombers, you know, different sizes, weights, distribution, all that stuff. She's actually one of a few women to hold the rank of first officer with the ATA. So she's legit on multiple levels at this point. Her marriage is over, but she's flying for the ATA. She's got sort of this potentially new lease on her aviation career where it might take her. And this takes us to January the 5th of 1941, a day that, if you know our show, will bring this full circle. Thoughts so far before we get into the disappearance?
Yeah, and she definitely is so far very much seems like the European counterpart of Amelia Earhart, even to the point of having a high profile marriage.
That's a good point.
A lot of similarities there.
Yeah.
She certainly seems like somebody that I would have loved to have met. She seems like definitely a badass, somebody that does whatever she wants. I mean, even getting a divorce in the 1930s.
Right.
That's terrifying.
And that time,
you know, like, she did her own thing. Mm-hmm. And I can see why people like this woman. Mm-hmm. She definitely seems super cool.
My first impressions of her when I first started looking into this was that she amplified the fine line that Earhart was able to walk, I think, with the masculine sides, the feminine sides, you know, just encompassing herself. She loved men, you know, she loved her relationships, she loved to date. She was very much sort of like a socialite version of an aviatrix at the time. You know, she sort of like combined a lot of the qualities of someone like Earhart and then like a Ruth Elder or Ruth Nichols or even like a Pancho Barnes in some aspects. Like, she was very different breed, I think, like a very different type of a person. I'm really sort of floored by her and what she was able to do. And yeah, the counterpart aspect of it is really interesting. All right, well, that brings us to January the 5th, 1941. So I'm going to give you a few scenarios here.
Okay.
The official one, I'm going to start with that, of course. That's where we're going to start, baseline. And then I'll give you some alternative explanations and potential twist endings, and then we'll get into it a little bit.
Okay.
So let's see how much of this sounds familiar to you situationally.
Okay.
Here is the official story as history has written it. On January the 5th, 1941, Amy Johnson is 37 years old. On that day, she's assigned to fly an Airspeed Oxford aircraft from Blackpool to RAF Kidlington near Oxford.
I don't know anything about these places. Is that a long flight?
Yeah, it's very different than Leigh to Howland.
So the short flight.
Very short.
Very short flight. Okay.
It's a routine ferry flight, something she'd performed many times before.
Okay.
The weather conditions that day are very, very poor.
That's mistake number one.
Right. So we'll see if you can sort of count out all of the little, some of a lot of little things as we've learned a lot in this show about. So a lot of fog, really affecting the visibility, covering most of the countryside, most of the water, of course. It's snowy. It's wet out. Overall, very bad conditions. Having said that, she decides to take off from Blackpool at around 3:30 p.m. as planned. It's a 90-minute flight.
Okay.
As she flies south, the weather conditions worsen, and she encounters really thick fog over the Thames estuary. This is not the first time we've talked about the Thames. The Thames is where they found Montague John Druitt.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, yes, you're right.
So it gets so bad that despite being an experienced pilot, she becomes disoriented, mm-hmm. and she loses her way. Mm-hmm. Another check mark, or another thing to look at, she's also flying without radio communication, mm-hmm. or reportedly very poor radio communication, because the types of planes that the ATA flew at the time were really bare bones. So think compass and maps, mm-hmm. and that's it. If you're lucky, you sometimes maybe get a radio, but it's sketchy at best.
Was she alone on this?
She was.
Okay. Which wouldn't have been a big deal normally, because it's a 90-minute flight that she's done a million times.
It makes it very difficult, obviously, to navigate and, of course, to communicate. So she has to bail out. Mm-hmm. She's out of time. She's got a chute. She's successful in her evacuation of the aircraft, but she hits freezing cold water and the current is intensely violent. There are immediate search attempts for her, including one very well-known one by the HMS Hazelmere. The captain of the Hazelmere, a gentleman by the name of Walter Fletcher, loses his own life in his attempts to rescue Amy from the water, and we ultimately lose Amy Johnson forever at that moment. A tragic accident. That's history as it's written. Thoughts on that?
So, okay, we know, though, where she went down, and this isn't like...
It's not like Earhart.
With Earhart, we do, like, she just lost radio communication and blipped away, and...
Right.
We know where she ended up.
Right.
The question we're about to talk about is
how she ended up there. So, yeah, unlike Earhart, it's not like we don't know where she's at, we just don't know how she got there, and it'll be a little more clear in a minute.
Okay. I have a follow-up question, and you may have said this, but just to clarify, we went from bad weather to her plane going down. What actually happened to the, like, what happened to, like, what made the plane stop working?
Fuel was the issue. Again, this is kind of like really similar. So she gets to this area and she starts to run low on fuel, okay. and she's in really bad weather and she becomes disoriented, probably eats a lot of fuel that she didn't necessarily need to eat.
Okay.
And she ends up having to make a call. She has to bail out. She has to get out of the plane. She's at that point.
This is like the Kobe Bryant helicopter. I'm not an eight. I don't fly and I don't know a ton about planes, mm-hmm. but like immediately that's the situation I'm reminded of where he went out in bad mm-hmm. weather and that is what happened.
Right.
He should never have flown in that weather.
Right.
Is this that?
It's speculation. It's an opinion. I mean, I would say that she probably should not have made the decision to make this flight.
Okay.
But I think if I'm making an argument against that, it is a flight that she'd made multiple times before. She was pretty experienced at this flight in particular. She probably thought, I can knock this out. The bad weather is bad weather, but I can make it. Who knows what went into that decision to make the flight, but she made the decision regardless.
Overconfidence.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of different things, you know, went into that potentially. So
just kind of in reading about accidents that happen at sea,
mm-hmm.
it's a very, very dangerous thing to be on the open sea.
Mm-hmm.
And you get so used to doing things that it's like, it's easy to not fully appreciate all the time how dangerous it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And being overconfident, not saying she was cocky,
mm-hmm.
but she had just done it so many times. Like, she just was, you know, like I go driving out in weather conditions I shouldn't drive in all the time because mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing.
And you make it all the time. So,
and I make it. And so, like, now I have this confirmation bias of mm-hmm. I can handle it if I want to drive in bad weather.
Yeah. I think you're spot on with that. I think that's probably all it went into it. It really probably really is that cut and dry. I didn't see anything anywhere to indicate that she was receiving any kind of pressure from the ATA or anything like that to make that flight at a certain time.
Yeah.
You know, there may have been deadlines. I'm sure that there were, but I don't think that factored into her.
Normal work stuff, though, like nothing out of the ordinary.
Yeah, nothing stepped in that was like, oh, this was like a real important deadline. She had to get this flight done or anything like that. I'm going to give you the next two because they're tightly intertwined.
Okay.
And I'm just going to sort of rewind a little bit. So essentially, theory one, to quickly recap, she gets into trouble when she runs out of fuel over the Thames Estuary. The weather's really bad. She becomes disoriented, probably eats a lot more fuel, probably is a little overconfident, and she has to bail out, hits the water. There is a slight ending on, a slight twist on the ending I just gave you, and this is theory number two. Not so much a theory, more of a slight adjustment to the very end of the story. So some say that in their efforts to rescue Amy, that she was actually overcome by the Hazelmere itself, which was the vessel that was there on the spot to try to rescue her. And she was actually pulled under the vessel, and that has a really tragic potential ending, or it just has the ending of her, of course, drowning very, very quickly, getting overcome. That's theory number two. It's really what happens when she hits the water.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, did they get to her or not?
This seems like one of those things where really there's no way to know if that happened or not, and the only people that would know that are the people on the ship, and they have absolutely no reason to come out and be like, oh yeah, it's our fault.
There's no way to know.
Right. That's tragic if that is what happened. And if that is what happened, I would imagine that the people on that ship carried around a lot of guilt with them.
Sure, of course.
And so I hope that that is not what happened. But yeah, that's kind of disturbing. Wow.
We're never going to know.
But like, that's not out of the realm of possibility.
It's not. And I think you might find this might be one of those cases where our determinations are, yeah, it could be any one of these things. When we get to the end, I think that'll make a lot more sense.
Okay.
So the third theory in this, it's a little more radical in its departure from the original story. It states that she approaches the Thames. Instead of bailing out, though, she attempts to make an emergency landing on the water, and her aircraft hits the water surface with great force, causing it to immediately break apart, wings snap off, all that jazz. And it's at that point that the Hazelmere actually gets involved, and ending number one or two occurs, depending on what you believe.
Well, was the plane recovered? And did anyone do any kind of analysis on the plane to see how hard it hit the water?
No analysis. The plane was never recovered. I've never seen anything on the plane being recovered.
Really?
Yeah, the wreckage was never recovered. I'm pretty sure I read that a couple times.
I would like to know why.
Well, maybe we'll look into that a little more. So her body was never recovered. The plane was never recovered. Nothing. Now, there are some eyewitness accounts, the people that were actually there trying to help rescue her.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that the captain of the Hazelmere lost his own life, ultimately, in trying to rescue her. So we do know that that actually all took place. That's not a myth. That's not a theory. That did happen. Those are three fairly tight versions of the same story for the most part, but with slightly different endings.
Mm-hmm.
Questions on that?
The Thames is a river.
It's partially enclosed.
I'm like mind blown that they didn't cover the plane. Yeah. I guess I wish I knew if that was intentional, like they just made the decision to let it go.
Right.
Or they couldn't find it. Again, comparing it to Earhart, it's the ocean. So I completely, and obviously that's going to be a difficult thing to locate.
Yeah.
But I don't, like, after all this time, why would no effort be made since, would you say 1941?
Yeah, 41, January 5th of 41.
In all of this time, the plane has never been recovered. Why?
It's a good question.
I don't know if there's an answer out there.
Yeah.
Like, I would, is it because we just haven't tried? Or have we tried and we can't find it? That's crazy to me that we don't have her plane. I would think so, because much like when they found the Titanic and they were able to kind of recreate,
right.
Which, by the way, that's super cool. That's
yeah.
one of my favorite things is yeah. like, I went through a period where I was like really obsessed with like getting into like the nitty, like all the James Cameron's like videos on YouTube where he got into the nitty gritty.
Oh, yeah.
Of, like
yeah.
first it cracked here and then it broke in half.
Yeah.
They can do crazy things with like being able to like analyze that plane and everything and come up with a theory of how hard it hit the water and where. And it's wild what they can do forensically.
We haven't even gotten to the best part yet.
Oh, there's better parts. Okay.
Well, there's one more alternate explanation that is, I guess I'll let you determine if it's radically different or not. Are we ready for the alternate one?
Hit me with the alternate theories.
Okay.
Alternative facts, alternative theories.
Alternative theory one, not plural this time.
Just one.
All right. So this all begins with the claim that hits the news in 1999.
Okay.
There's a retired soldier. He's a former gunner. And his name is Tom Mitchell.
Okay.
Now, he comes forward decades after this event, and he says that he actually was the one to shoot down Johnson's aircraft because she flew into airspace over, let me say this, hopefully I get this right, Iwade. I think that's how you say it. Flew into airspace over Iwade, which is a little village that's like sort of in the countryside area of Kent. So Kent's a larger area, obviously. The theory goes that Mitchell was one of about 20 or so soldiers that were basically tasked with watching the immediate airspace in that area. And they're given explicit instructions to shoot anything down that didn't properly identify itself via radio.
And this is 1941, right?
This is 1941.
Okay.
This is January of 41, too. So remember, December 7th of 41, this is just after Pearl Harbor. I mean, just after it.
Which, by the way, we're American. So for us, World War II didn't start until Pearl Harbor. We understand it had been going on for quite a bit over in Europe.
Thank you for that disclaimer.
Just before you email us and be like, stupid Americans, not everything is about you. We get it. We get it. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And it's true. Not everything is about us. Absolutely. The way aircraft was able to properly identify itself via radio was they had this color of the day. It was very, very specific. It was very general. It wasn't anything crazy. The way it worked is all pilots making any kind of flights over that area would be made aware of a color of the day, literally like red or blue or green or something.
Oh, that's also how they do drug tests for probation people. Just FYI.
I didn't know that. There you go. Learning stuff.
Yeah, if you're on probation, they call you every morning and give you a color. They give a list of colors. And if your color is listed, you have to go do a drug test. That's how they do random drug tests if you're on probation.
I'll be damned.
So
very interesting.
Sorry that my squirrel brain just interrupted your story. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. That's a random fact that everybody now knows that's listening to this. They have this color of the day, as you just mentioned. It's really used a lot in this. It's just used to identify them so they know that they're not potential enemy aircraft. They won't get shot down. Now, from the ground, according to Mitchell, they did make the request twice via radio, according to Mitchell's account, and Amy failed to give the right answer both times. This is, of course, because she either had no radio equipment at all or her radio has malfunctioned at this point. Well, they take no chances and they begin to open fire. And according to his story, they fire 16 rounds into the sky. Now, I couldn't determine how many of those rounds actually potentially hit Amy's plane in this scenario, but she immediately goes down.
No, if even they would know.
Right. It's a crapshoot. Of course, the soldiers couldn't tell what happened to the plane specifically or where it exactly hit the water, but they don't find out until the next day when the story hits the papers that it was actually Amy Johnson, who was a very famous person at the time. So presumably, most of the ending of parts one or two, depending on what you believe, still happens. In this case, though, she's forced down as opposed to coming down of her own volition or an emergency situation or something of that nature. So my immediate thoughts on this is that it's plausible. I mean, I'm kind of 50-50 on it. I mean, something interesting that I didn't know prior to doing research on this story, we've learned a few things tonight, was that during wartime, the British would fly what were referred to as barrage balloons over their airspace, Buckingham Palace and some other really important areas. And they did this to make it more difficult for potential raids by Nazi bombers. I only bring this up because I've also read online that Amy may have seen those balloons and mistaken her position for being over land. So she bails out, thinking she's on land, and in fact, she's over water. She hits the water, it's too late, it's freezing cold, everything unfolds as we talked about earlier, and she drowns. So for what it's worth, for your consideration, thoughts on the potential of her being shot down and not coming down of her own volition?
I guess my question is it possible that they shot down a plane and then saw this story and made an assumption? I would imagine if you're going to shoot down a plane, there's going to be some record of it.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine.
Therein lies the problem.
No record. I'm assuming you're about to tell me.
No record.
There's no record.
No record.
Okay. Well, that kind of makes me wonder if it happened.
Listen. Let me get it out.
Okay,
no record.
Sorry.
I swear.
I'm sorry.
I swear I'm coming to
a... Give me your flat earth stuff. I'm listening.
I swear I'm getting to a point at this point.
Okay.
No record. But he's got a plausible reason for it, in my opinion, I think. You know, this is wartime Britain. This is a very serious time. And Amy Johnson was an icon. She, at the time, she was a really big name. The way Mitchell describes it is that they were told the next day when they saw in the papers that it was in fact Johnson, they were actually told by superiors to never speak of it because they didn't want anything to get out in a time in wartime Britain that everybody was really sensitive. And it would have been really bad if it was friendly fire or somebody else that shot down Johnson. They wanted to sort of leave it as it was. And that was his reasoning for not really ever saying anything until, of course, decades later when everybody had, of course, probably died from it.
So basically, we shot her, we covered it up.
Right.
I feel bad.
Right.
When he came forward with the story, was he the only one left alive of anybody that would have known about this? Did anyone else ever come forward and be like, yeah, he's right, I was there, this is what we did?
No.
So it's really only him. Okay.
It's a lone witness account, but potentially a firsthand witness account.
Yeah.
Does that change anything for you? We've talked about this a lot on the show, but it is a different situation in the fact that this guy is saying, oh yeah,
I might have killed her.
Yeah. If it's right, as you talked about earlier, there really is no way. We'll never really know.
There's no way of knowing.
But if he's right, it's plausible to me. I think it's there's nothing out of the ordinary in this.
No, I don't think it's implausible. I think it's hard to judge a person's credibility when, like, the only thing I can see is, like, a newspaper article that quotes him.
Yeah.
I mean, I really wish we had, like, a video interview of this person. Like, because then you can really, like, judge for yourself, like, with his mannerisms and how he speaks. Like, you can really judge whether or not you think he's being sincere. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. However, I mean, I don't really see what benefit of saying this if it's not true, you know, because you're basically coming out and being like, no, I killed her on accident and I feel bad about it.
Yeah.
And to me, I don't know why you would say that.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to gain from it? Ultimately,
there's no reason to say that.
Mm-hmm. Besides a little press, maybe. But I mean, he's 83.
Maybe. But like, that's not good press.
Right. Maybe he just wanted to, you know, I'm putting words in his mouth, obviously, and I'm, but this is all speculation, just so people know that are listening, but maybe he just had a guilty enough conscience that he wanted to get it off his chest. It's a historical thing. I really kind of think of it in the same way as if Japanese capture for Amelia Earhart proves tomorrow to be accurate or what happened, I feel like the world has a right to know. Maybe he was the only living person left in possession of this knowledge of what happened that day, and he just had a guilty enough conscience where, like, before I die, I want to get this out. The world should know this is actually what happened that day. And I don't feel like there's anything. Yeah, as you mentioned, there's nothing for him to really gain. He didn't gain anything by this. He just told the story.
Yeah.
Got a little bit of coverage.
It's interesting, too, because say that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So let's just say for a second that this is what happened. I wonder how differently this all would have played out if they had recovered the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got 16 bullet holes in it.
Sure.
Like, what do you do? Like, what do you...
Yeah.
What do you do? You are actively being told by your boss, don't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have been scared out of my mind that they were going to find that mm-hmm. plane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, it's like, it seems a little silly to, like, go ahead and delete records when you have no idea if your boss at the military is going to come knocking on your door because they recovered a plane with 16 bullet holes in it. Like, that's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, it makes it kind of unbelievable. But then on the other hand, it also cuts the other way for me, too, because it's like, I'm sitting here, I feel bad about something. My boss has told me not to tell, mm-hmm. so I'm not going to tell. And I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm spending my whole life just waiting for them to find that plane and mm-hmm. come ask me what happened so I can finally tell what I know. And then it never happens. And so it's like, well, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's also plausible. And so, like, to me, like, it really could go both ways. I don't know, but it's really interesting twist to the mm-hmm. story for sure.
Yeah. And if you think about it, if they never find the plane, if that's the case, and it's likely they never will because of the position the plane is in, where it's located, what condition it might be in, this would be, if it's true, the only positive evidence we would have for telling the ending to Johnson's story ultimately, because if he's the only one and he was there, firsthand account, and he's accurate. I don't know. We've dealt with a lot of firsthand, or we've dealt with a lot of witness testimony and stuff in the show, and I feel like this one just doesn't feel the same as everybody else's. It just feels like, well, very well plausibly could have happened, you know, just as easily this way as it could have the other few ways that I outlined earlier. Could have been weather, could have been the sum of a lot of things. It could have been in wartime Britain that she was shot down.
It could have been. Yeah, but if this is what happened, I still think the weather played a part.
Yeah, sure, probably. All of the above, maybe.
Maybe their rule was she got the wrong code,
mm-hmm.
she gets shot down because we're in the middle of a war mm-hmm. and this is how we have to be. If that's the case, why lie about it? Like, that seems like you didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what actually happened, you didn't do anything wrong. Why are you erasing?
Maybe he was just simply told by a superior.
It's always the cover-up. It's always the cover-up. It's never the crime. It's always the cover-up. It's always worse. Universal truth.
There are a lot of people I could bring in to discuss what may have happened to Amy that day, but I only ever had one choice. A man I've been trying to get on this show for years, looking for an excuse to include him in any story we've covered. And now, finally, the time has come.
The first thing I think I really wanted to ask you about is this idea that Amy is sort of a British version of Amelia Earhart. And you live in the UK, you're over in that area, born and raised. I want to ask you what your thought is on that. Is that a fair statement for me to make? Is she as iconic as Amelia Earhart without the name recognition?
I think that's probably a fair thing to say, to be honest, Chris. I think for us over here in the UK, I think she was very much sort of the equivalent of Amelia Earhart,
mm-hmm.
certainly in popular culture, and certainly in respect of the adulation she got from people over here at the time. You know, I think she was probably seen as famous, if not probably more famous than Amelia Earhart was over here in the UK.
Chris Hare has been waiting in the wings for a long time. He lives in history, studying it as an undergrad and going on to receive his master's degree in historical research, awarded with distinction. He's a one-of-a-kind researcher, willing to discuss and investigate any theory that's put in front of him. Most of all, he's my friend, and I'm lucky to know him. You are too, you just don't know it yet. But after tonight's episode, though, you will.
let's talk a little bit about her career. I mean, give me your highlights. Give me your thoughts of what you think is the one thing, or maybe multiple things we should be looking at. You know, this woman was, from everything I've read, the limited knowledge I have, she seemed to, again, echo Earhart's fearlessness. There was a fierceness to her. She was, I think she took Earhart's line and she amplified it. She was very feminine. She loved men. She loved her relationships, but she was down and dirty. She could kick ass. She could do a lot of things. She was a real genuine, like, take no shit, take no prisoners kind of a woman, it felt like. And I think her career reflects that. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah. And a lot of it stems back, you know, from the time of the British Empire, mm-hmm. you know, when we sent people off to explore all different parts of the world, you know, so there's a lot of history there and, you know, a very long tradition of people going off on exploration and exploring things and doing things that were being done for the first time. And I think Amy fits quite nicely into that tradition. A lot of what she did in aviation was sort of emulating that in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, traditionally, it had been done by men. So Amy was breaking the mold somewhat here by, you know, sort of being, you know, the first woman to do some of these things. The other interesting thing about Amy is that sort of over here in the UK, aviation, particularly for women, and there weren't very many of them, mm-hmm. was typically the preserve of, you know, sort of titled aristocracy, very, very wealthy people, mm-hmm. people like Lady Heath, who had sort of the money and the leisure time to be able to indulge in these sorts of passions. And mm-hmm. although Amy wasn't necessarily from a poor background, you know, she was from quite a wealthy background because of her mm-hmm. father's fishing business. She did break the mold in some respects because she wasn't titled.
That's a good point.
You know, from that point of view, you know, she was quite different. And she came from Hull, you know, over in Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. She was a slightly different person compared to the ladies in the UK that were flying at that time. And I think that marks her out, you know, is very different. But certainly in terms of her fearlessness, when you look at what she did flying, although she had certain fears about what might happen to them and the inherent dangers, particularly flying over the water, she was quite frightened of ending up, you know, sort of going in the drink, as us Brits would say, mm-hmm. and possibly being eaten by sharks. Mm-hmm. But I think she accepted that in quite a sort of jovial way. I don't think it certainly didn't stop her from flying, and I don't think it ever would have. You know, there's a very famous incident, I think, where she, you know, during her flight to Australia, which I think is probably her crowning glory, she had to sort of land in Timor. And when she landed, you know, she managed to avoid all these termite hills. You know, by the time she ends up landing Jason, these local tribespeople came out to meet her and they had knives between the teeth and, you know, looking really fearsome. And there's Amy. And the first thing she does is she grabs hold of a revolver and essentially prepares to defend herself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it all turns out okay, but I think that particular incident really gives you an idea of just how courageous this lady was. She was, you know, fearless in the air. She was doing all of this on her own as well. And I think she was more than prepared, you know, to stand up for herself and protect herself if need be.
That's a great story. I love that. In season one, we talked a lot about the aeronautical environment. We talked about what it was like in the sky, especially on the US side with a lot of the female pilots. What was it like over on the UK side? Is it much of the same? It's experimental, it's risky, it's very scary, some of these things that Amy Johnson and some of the other British pilots would have been doing.
Yeah, you know, it was a dangerous profession. You know, there's absolutely mm-hmm. no doubt about that. When you look at, you know, the increased use of aviation during the First World War, you know, people were becoming more interested in aviation, mm-hmm. the Wright brothers' flight. But yeah, I mean, over here, it was very similar to what was going on in the US. I think people were generally interested in aviation. And I think one of the things that captured people's imagination, you know, more was the fact that this was a lady doing this. You know, we were used to, you know, sort of men who'd flown with the Royal Flying Corps during the First World War doing some of the flying. But all of a sudden, you've got this lady who pops up, who is very single-minded. She's very brave. She's very courageous. And she wants to fly, although initially, I think she tried flying and wasn't that impressed with it. But subsequently, she got an interest in it. And with Amy as well, the difference there was, I think, women weren't just necessarily taking an interest in flight. They were also taking an interest in the machines.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite an interesting difference, I think, over here, is that in the UK, Amy was probably as interested about learning about aircraft,
yeah,
and the engineering side of aircraft and how to look after them, you know, as she was about flying, it was sort of the complete package, if you like. She would spend hours working on the aircraft and, you know, on a flight to Australia, although she did allow some of the other, you know, mechanics at the various places she stopped to work on the aircraft, mm-hmm. sometimes with less favorable results. She was very interested in sort of being able to look after the aircraft herself and, you know, spent many, many hours working on them. And I think that's quite interesting because she was interested in sort of almost everything to do with aviation.
Well, let's get into some of the theory. Earlier, listeners got the 10,000 foot view of some of the theories from myself, but I wanted to speak with you about them. I know there are a few others. Some are, you know, sort of out in the ether, but not really worth talking about, but I do want to hear them all. And I would love to have you sort of give me potential outcomes for Amy Johnson's last flight. What are some of the prevailing theories out there about what happened to her?
The most basic one, if you like, is that essentially the day she took off from RAF Squires Gate, which is in Blackpool, which is where I live, on her way to RAF Kidlington, which is in Oxfordshire, the weather was bad. There was mm-hmm. very heavy cloud cover. It was icy. There was snow. You know, these sorts of conditions on the day, although the Airspeed Oxford that she flew had, you know, a carburetor in it to de-ice certain parts of the plane, it didn't include that for the wings. Mm-hmm. So there was always a danger when they were flying in those sorts of conditions that the wings could ice up, you know, which was dangerous. Mm-hmm. So the weather on the day was pretty bad. And although the flight to RAF Kidlington was, when you compare it to her flight to Australia of 11,000 miles, it was relatively short. Mm-hmm. You know, we're only talking just over, I think it's about 130 miles or something like that. It's not far. It looks like a really short flight. But actually, the route that she was going to take on that particular day wasn't necessarily an easy flight. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this was during wartime. She would have to fly from RAF Squires Gate through a narrow passage between Liverpool to the west and Widnes to the east of barrage balloons, mm-hmm. which obviously were in place,
yeah,
to try and push German bombers up higher to reduce their accuracy.
Very cool. Different type of defense. We talked about that at the top of the show a little bit. I thought that was really interesting.
You know, us Brits are known for being quite innovative when it comes to things like this. But obviously they pose a significant danger for planes.
Sure.
You know, so she would have to fly down that corridor, you know, again, sort of skirt around the industrial areas of Birmingham, and then head off to RAF Kidlington. But again, you've got, it's a fairly mountainous area. Mm-hmm. You have other sorts of obstructions. So although it's a short flight, it's not an easy one, and the weather's bad. Mm-hmm. The main theory, and the generally accepted one, and I think this is the one that was accepted by the RAF accident branch, is that because of this cloud, Amy essentially, and she told people she was going to do this on the day, because the other thing is she was told not to fly, but for whatever reason, she decided on the day that she was still going to undertake this flight.
Yeah.
And what she said was she was going to fly up above the clouds. And I think the phrase she used was she was going to smell her way to Kidlington, which is, you know, it's an interesting term, but obviously get above the clouds. Now, the problem with this is she didn't have any navigation equipment on the plane other than a compass and a few basic things. And there's even the suggestion that that wasn't working properly.
Yeah, we had heard different things about she had no radio at all because those planes were, the ATA planes were bare bones, or if she did have a radio, it was really severely malfunctioned. We've heard different things.
I think the generally accepted theory is that there was no radio on board the aircraft because it was a brand new aircraft that was being delivered from Prestwick up in Scotland to, you know, where it was needed, and they would generally fit all the radios and things once they were actually at the training center.
Got it.
So bearing in mind she's potentially got a faulty compass, heavy cloud cover, and the general theory is that because of this she got lost and couldn't find RAF Kidlington.
Is she out in the elements in that Oxford, or is she actually in a cockpit?
It is an enclosed aircraft.
Okay.
The Oxford was a training aircraft, so she's enclosed.
Okay.
But obviously because of this cloud cover, she can't find RAF Kidlington. And one of the ideas is that what she was looking for was a break in the clouds to try and drop down and be able to find it. And potentially she flew a little bit too far east. Mm-hmm. And obviously ends up, you know, more than 100 miles off course. Mm. By this point, she's several hours overdue, you know, at the point of fuel exhaustion.
Eating fuel.
Yeah. I think the maximum time in the air for the aircraft was about, 3¾ hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when she sees these barrage balloons, now normally barrage balloons were above land.
Mm-hmm.
And I think upon seeing these barrage balloons, it's believed that Amy thought she was over land.
Yeah.
And so at that point, decided to jump out.
I did read that.
Subsequently, as we'll discuss, those barrage balloons were actually being flown by ships that were in the Thames estuary. There was a convoy going in. I mean, that's the most basic theory, is that, you know, she just got lost.
Yeah.
She ran out of fuel, parachuted out over the sea, and unfortunately went into the water, which was very cold at the time, and died as a result of that.
Where does it go from there? That's baseline. That's what we talk about. We talked about for Earhart, you know, she was going from Leigh to Howland. That's baseline. She got lost at sea. Where do we go from here when it comes to Johnson theory-wise?
I mean, I don't think there's too many people who don't believe that generally that's what happened. There's a few other little things that start creeping into it. I mean, one of the suggestions is potentially that, you know, she was on some sort of secret flight, mm-hmm. you know, a clandestine flight to Europe at the time. And although it's true that I think Amy had approached what we call the Special Operations Executive, SOE, to try and help them, I think they'd actually turned her down at the time, you know, in part because of, you know, her celebrity. But I think the thing that rules out a clandestine flight is the aircraft that she was using.
Right.
So the Airspeed Oxford was a training aircraft, and the one that Amy was flying was in standard camouflage pattern on the top,
mm-hmm.
which was sort of like a dark earth green camouflage colour.
Mm-hmm.
But training aircraft on the underside were painted bright yellow. Now that, you would say, that's not a particularly good colour to be using if you're on a clandestine flight. And I think it's generally accepted that any such flights that the British did do, you know, sort of particularly later in the war, were undertaken using a different type of aircraft called a Lysander, which was obviously painted in very dark colours so that it couldn't be seen. And all of those flights were undertaken at night. Amy here was flying during the day, bright yellow on the underside of the aircraft. And that was primarily to identify it as a friendly aircraft.
Mm.
So I think from that point of view, I think it's quite unlikely. But also, the Oxford had a... how could I say, a little idiosyncrasy with the way that you got out of the plane. You had to manually jettison the back door to get out.
Hmm.
And so, you know, if you were, for example, dropping a parachutist over occupied Europe or something like that, having to actually jettison the door to let them out is not really a good idea. So I think the fact that the aircraft was wholly unsuited to such a clandestine operation, the colours it was painted in, you know, and also I don't think there's any evidence in any of the records, you know, that she was on such an operation, particularly flying from RAF Squires Gate in Blackpool, which, you know, for listeners in, you know, sort of the US, is it's about halfway up the west coast of the UK.
Mm.
As I say, the maximum endurance of the Oxford wasn't that great, nearly 4 hours, 5 hours. So Squires Gate wouldn't really have been the best point to go from on a clandestine operation either.
I do want to ask you, because you're just talking about this being a training aircraft, and it's certainly a friendly craft. It's always meant to be that way. It's visualized that way. I want to ask you about Tom Mitchell's account that came out in 99.
Yeah.
About him potentially shooting down, being the one to shoot down Johnson's aircraft. They don't really mention anything about how far away the aircraft might have been. They do say where they were stationed and where they noticed the aircraft.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how it's possible, I guess it's very possible under the weather conditions, that they could have seen that visually and still shot it down, even though they radioed to her twice. Of course, she doesn't have a radio, so she's never going to respond. How does that work?
That's one of the big points.
Would they have shot her down? Is it orders above general protocol in that situation? Like, hey, we know it's a potentially a friendly plane. We know it's not a military aircraft. It's, you know, it's a training aircraft. We could see the yellow potentially. I'm speculating here, but would they have shot down anyway in that situation? Or would they have looked at that and said, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't shoot this? Or could they just not have seen it?
It's difficult to say, I suppose. If they had a visual on the aircraft, the yellow underside would have revealed it as a friendly aircraft. We do know that the Oxford didn't have the identification friend or foe radar aboard. So there was no electronic means to identify the aircraft as friendly to, you know, to any anti-aircraft gun positions in the area. I think the position that Tom Mitchell was in on the day was at a place called Ewade on the Thames estuary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where Amy's aircraft is reported to have gone down is 20 miles away.
Mm.
So one of the issues here is that, you know, even the heaviest anti-aircraft guns couldn't reach that sort of distance. potentially she could have flown past them nearer to where they were. But I think it's interesting that if they had fired on Amy's aircraft, when it crashed, the crew of HMS Hazelmere didn't see that the aircraft was struggling or in flames or anything to suggest that it, for example, had been hit by anti-aircraft fire. But I think the biggest thing for ruling this out, and obviously you feel terrible for Mr. Mitchell, who I think carried this burden for a long time, is that they said they actually contacted the aircraft and the aircraft gave the wrong signal. So they were asked on the day for, there was a color of the day.
That's right.
Or a series of colors.
And he requested it twice.
Yeah. So in response to being challenged, the pilot of the aircraft would sort of, I think they had to fire a flare pistol with the correct colors. And obviously this aircraft didn't do that. But Mr. Mitchell's account suggests that they actually contacted this aircraft by radio. Now, we know that Amy's aircraft didn't have a radio.
That's right.
And so I think on that basis, that is strong evidence that the aircraft that they shot at wasn't hers. But there's also probably more conclusive evidence that it wasn't Amy's aircraft they shot at, because the war diary for that particular unit, obviously some of the researchers that have looked into this, discovered that the time at which Mr. Mitchell's anti-aircraft gun emplacement opened fire was around about 6 o'clock in the evening, and they fired between 6 o'clock in the evening and just up to midnight. Now, from other witnesses that we've got, specifically those aboard the Hazelmere and some of the other vessels in the convoy, she's believed to have gone down between 3:30, 3:45 in the afternoon.
So the timing's not right.
So the timing isn't right. Now, potentially, I know people have mentioned in the past that there could be some sort of cover-up and that potentially, you know, shooting down Britain's most famous aviatrix wouldn't have been, you know, very good news to report in the middle of a war unless you start doubting the time those shells were fired by that anti-aircraft unit. I think all of the evidence seems to suggest that Mr. Mitchell, unfortunately, was feeling guilty about something that I don't think he really did. It was more likely to be German aircraft that they fired out. And I think in, you know, when you look at his account, he does actually say they couldn't even tell whether they hit the aircraft. So there was no positive confirmation.
Yeah.
I think it was maybe just the coincidence of hearing about, you know, sort of the fact that Amy had died, you know, we read about it in the press, and sort of putting two and two together and getting five.
Yeah.
So it seems.
I certainly don't doubt Mr. Mitchell's guilt and his conscience. I think it's really wonderful that he came forward and broke that story. He may have been mistaken as to what aircraft they were actually shooting at, but I think it seems very plausible to me that he likely believed that he shot down Johnson and not somebody else. I just get that feeling from sort of what I've read and what I've seen from his account. And he doesn't seem like he's trying to get anything there. Like, it just seems like he's trying to really just empty out his conscience, you know, and just clear his conscience for it.
I don't think he had a particular angle on this and certainly had nothing to gain. I think one of the things that possibly bothered him was that he was sort of told by his officers not to mention this.
Yeah.
And I think, believing he was bound by the Official Secrets Act, he didn't say anything. But the other way you could look at that is that, you know, again, it was wartime, you know, the news she'd died. You know, the officers may well have said to him, don't go starting rumors off, because that's the other side of these things, is that, you know, even the slightest rumor that potentially their unit had shot Amy Johnson down, you know, even if it wasn't true, as appears to be the case, such a rumor, I think, would have spread quite quickly and would have looked very, very bad, you know, on the units involved. So I can fully understand that the officers might have said, look, I know you've seen these newspaper reports about her death and, you know, we were shooting at an aircraft that day. Perhaps don't go around suggesting that it was Amy Johnson's plane we shot down when there's no evidence for that. Because you can imagine a story like that would have spread like wildfire.
Yeah, especially during that time.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily think the officers telling him to keep quiet is something that, you know, is conspiratorial. I think it was probably just sound advice.
I want to ask you about the wreckage, because Jen mentioned this and I didn't know, frankly. I didn't see anything about it. We looked at it last night and I did see that back in, I think it was 2002 or 2003, there was a gentleman by the name of Leo Sheridan who was leading potentially an expedition out to the potential wreck site where Johnson's aircraft was at, and they were going to try to pull it up. And of course, he passes away, unfortunately, and back in 22, which is not that long ago. I don't know what ever came, if anything, of that potential expedition. I know it's in a little bit of a rough spot. It's kind of similar to Buka in that nature. Can you explain potentially where this aircraft went down and why it might be so difficult to recover? I mean, are we ever going to be able to recover this aircraft, or is it just lost to history at this point?
It is a busy area. There's a lot of wreckage, I think, has gone down in that particular area over the years. I think it's one of those situations where we will probably never find the wreckage. The aircraft itself was made predominantly out of wood. So you would be in that sort of situation where after all of this time, potentially what you would be looking at recovering is the engines. It was a twin engine plane. These sorts of artifacts can move on the seabed. And I think the RAF have a fairly good idea of where the aircraft actually went down, the coordinates. But of course, knowing where the aircraft hit the water, it doesn't necessarily follow that that's where the wreckage actually ended up on the seabed. It could have moved around. So there's deep sediment, you know, the sandbanks and things like that can shift in the area. So it may be that we never find the wreckage. I know at the time there was some wreckage recovered from the aircraft bearing, you know, some of the serial numbers of her aircraft, you know, at the time, which I think satisfied them that it was her aircraft. Obviously, the serial number was V3540. And at the time, they discovered some pieces of wreckage with the numbers 35 on and yellow fabric. So, but they also found some of her personal possessions, you know, her luggage bag, her logbook, you know, some other personal effects. I think they even found some Christmas presents that she'd been given by her sister, Molly, who also lived in Blackpool, and she'd spent the night with her before her final flight. So I think because of the nature of the area, because of the tides, because of the length of time, I would be very surprised if the wreckage is ever found.
For the record, we do have some recovery of the aircraft, of the wreckage, and we do have a partial match for a serial number. So that really does tell a good portion of the end of the story of what happened to Amy Johnson, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think we do. And I think we also have the eyewitness accounts of the crew aboard HMS Hazelmere, you know, which was one of the ships that was in the convoy who tried to rescue. And some of the crewmen there actually saw what they described as a fresh-faced woman in the water wearing a flying helmet. And I think at that point, you've got to say, well, who else could it have been? They saw the aircraft descending and circling someone who'd parachuted out, and then they see this lady in the water. So I don't think there's any doubt that she went into the water and that she crashed, you know, in the Thames estuary. So I think that's pretty conclusive.
In death, Amy became a legend, a symbol of courage and determination that all of us can look to now whenever we doubt that something just may be impossible to achieve. As I said at the top of tonight's episode, this is a story you'd likely never heard of until now. But what about the very first story we ever told on this show? Where are we with that? After leaving the story of Amelia Earhart 2 full seasons ago, I find it appropriate to bring the show full circle and give you some updates in some areas that we weren't able to previously. Next, we revisit the story our show made its name with, and we expand our investigation into the Earhart web with some brand new documentation on a theory in the case that was among the most controversial we ever covered. Even though the shows may end, and we may move on to other stories, our investigation into the vanishing of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan never has. See you soon. This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishpod. On social media, search the handle @vanishpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. This show is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Incorporated. Madhouse Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Madhouse Films production, copyright 2023. All rights reserved.